Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Really competing against yourself 90% of the time. It's a characteristic of your personality that you want to keep challenging yourself to do new things. And we'd be naive to say that it is a healthy sport all around.
Simone Biles goes out in Tokyo and executes the exact routine that Kamenechi did in 76. What would she score?
So welcome to our special on gymnastics as we looked at all the smaller sports that we see at Olympic Games in Tokyo this year. And today we have a very special guest with us. It's going to take us through some of the intricacies of gymnastics. And we've got Helen Bain, who is a gymnastics coach and athlete. She's somebody that has been very involved in the sport for many, many years. Lots of knowledge in there. But she's also worked as a biokineticist. She's also worked as a biomechanist and lots of different aspects that feed into that knowledge of gymnastics. And I think for Ross and I, talking to somebody like Helen, as you said in the intro, it's quite nice to watch the sport with a bit more knowledge than we had. And I certainly learnt a huge amount in the 50 minutes that we got to chat to her.
So did I. And I mean, I've watched the Olympic gymnastics competitions every game since 96. And for me, it's certainly one of the three centerpieces. You know, you have track and field, you have swimming and gymnastics. But having watched so many Olympic gymnastics competitions, I'm almost embarrassed to say I don't really know what's going on. And certainly not the way that Helen sees it as a biomechanist and a coach and an athlete who's done it herself. And so when your mind is suddenly opened up and you appreciate that a person is doing something that is both physiologically and technically borderline impossible for every other human in the world, that's when you're watching Simone Biles, then hopefully people start to get much more out of the Olympic gymnastics competitions than they otherwise would have. So, yeah, I feel enlightened as a consequence of this conversation.
Well, if you mean to be enlightened and know more about what you're watching in Tokyo, here is our interview with Helen Bain. So welcome to the Science of Sport podcast, Helen. Thanks very much for joining us today. And as you will see in the next half an hour or so, it's fair to say that Ross and I are not particularly good when it comes to the details of gymnastics, which is exactly why we have you on the podcast today. So I'm going to kick off the discussion, and hopefully that will lead to many other questions that we have around Simone Biles, probably the most famous gymnast in the world right now. Is she really the greatest that's ever lived?
Yes, short answer. I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone that could disagree with that. You would probably find some people that say she's pushing on the greatest athlete that's ever lived. That might be a little bit more controversial.
So why do you say that?
Well, I think, you know, so, I mean, from a gymnastics point of view, she's never lost an all-around competition since I think it's 2013. That includes the World and Olympic Championships in that time. She has a number of skills named after her, four in total now, could become five soon. Skills named after gymnasts doesn't necessarily make them the best gymnasts that ever lived, but the ones, in her case specifically, those skills are by virtue of their difficulty, you know, really pushing the limits of performance. So they're not just original, they're supremely difficult. So she does these incredibly difficult skills with very consistent performances, and it makes her pretty much unbeatable. You know, she even has mistakes in certain competitions, but she's still so far ahead of the rest of the competitors.
So within gymnastics, can you give us an example of a skill? Yeah, can you give us an example? Like, we're watching now the gymnastics. What's her best event? And don't say all of them.
yeah, so
like
best event probably floor and vault.
So I've seen some footage, I'm sure many listeners have seen, going around on Twitter, these super slow-mos, and you just look at this and you think this is like defying physics. Yeah. So we're watching the floor now, and she's going to do something that is just going to make the non-existent crowd breath go away. What is that thing? Yeah. And the thing I always wonder is, why can she do it? Was it her imagination to create it, or was it her physiology or her biomechanics, both, to enable it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it must be
exactly
both, obviously.
So on the floor, the major impressive move that she'll do is called a triple twisting double back. So at the end of the tumbling run, which starts with a round off back flip, and then the final skill at the end of the tumbling pass, she'll do two backward somersaults and three twists in the air. No other female gymnast has competed that, although I know one of her teammates is training it, and only a handful of men have done it. So and the question of how she's able to do these things that no one else has done before is a combination of her physical capacity. So she's obviously got incredible capacity for strength and power production, but to me it's more what sets her apart is her technical proficiency is so exceptional, because when you're operating at that limit, that level of difficulty, the margin for error is almost nothing. So she has to execute things so perfectly in order to get these skills right. So, for example, you know, if you break down a little bit further, if you were going to do just a single standing somersault in the air compared to a double back somersault, you need more time in the air, you need greater angular momentum to complete that skill. Right. And so the margin for error, if you're doing a simple back somersault and you get it a little bit wrong, you've got room to adjust and still land safely. And the harder the skills get, the less margin for error there is. And the more perfect you have to be in, for example, the takeoff parameters to be able to execute that. And she does that. That's what she does well.
Because it's interesting, because when you watch these super slow motions, and I'm sure you know the one I'm talking about, or one of, you think it's impossible that she's going to bring this around and rotate enough in the last however many milliseconds it is to land it. And so that is a consequence of, A, the height she gets, which is a function of power, and maybe we can explore like how much power that takes. But it's also the, and I mean, from a technical perspective, what goes into creating that angular momentum?
Yeah, so it's funny you say that, because when you hear what she's going to do, you think it's going to be impossible. But when I watch those super slow-mos, kind of with a coaching / biomechanics eye, I don't for one split second think she's not going to make it. I marvel that she's able to do it. But, you know, from the moment of takeoff and the timing that she executes those movements, it's clear that she's going to make it, which is not always the same for the other gymnasts. So how do you generate when you're doing these aerial movements, it's all about the takeoff, because once you're in the air, number one, your flight path that you're going to travel is set. So the path that your center of mass is going to travel, you can't change that after you're in the air. All you can do is change how much you're going to rotate, somersault or twist or whatever. So at the point of takeoff, that flight path is determined by how fast you're traveling and the angle you're traveling at. Also the height. Right. So if you take off from a higher height and land lower, that gives you more time in the air, but that's not really that relevant in gymnastics. So it's how fast in the angle you're traveling at takeoff. And then the amount of rotation you've got, so angular momentum is also set once you're in the air, and until something else, an external force is going to act on the person. Like when they land, they're going to now slow down their rotation. So the angular momentum that you've got is fixed, the total amount, but you can vary the speed of your rotation by changing your body position.
Yes.
So if you're in a straight laid out.
Is that the technical side? In other words, when you talk about her technical ability, the rotation, the speed of the rotation, is that what you would then define as technical ability?
Yeah, exactly. And what she's doing leading up to takeoff. So to generate that perfect takeoff position, that's going to be the direction and the speed she's traveling at. So the lead up skills of the round off backflip into takeoff is also technically really important, although they're simple skills. So she gets that part right first. Then once she's in the air and she's got this amount of angular momentum to kind of play with, she manipulates her body so precisely, and so that she either increases the speed of rotation in a somersault, increases the speed of the rotation in the twist. So one really nice example, I use this in teaching all the time, is her other skill on floor that's named after her is she does a double layout back somersault, and right at the last minute does this half twist and sort of lands facing opposite direction. And it's beautiful to watch because she does this somersaulting motion in a straight body laid out position twice, and then right at the last minute she drops her one arm to one side, which shifts some of that angular momentum from the somersault motion into the twisting around her own axis, and then lands half a turn facing the other direction. It's beautiful.
This concept you're talking about now, like just to try and help listeners conceptualize, if you ever sit on a rotating chair and you spin it around and you then tuck your arms to your chest, and as you hug yourself, you'll see that you accelerate. And if you then put your arms out like a bird coming into land, you'll slow down. Have you played like this, Mike?
Yes.
I remember in physics,
gracefully though.
First year university physics, you can do this, and it shows you this concept Helen's talking about. And also Winter Olympics ice skating, you see it really done when they're doing their spin. I don't know if that's not the right word, but they will change their speed of rotation enormously by just changing the orientation of the arms. It's quite amazing actually to look
at. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
I know that we're sort of maybe drilling down as far as we can and using Simone Biles as an example of this. If you had to do some sort of basic tests, for instance, compare her flexibility to another world-class athlete, compare her ability to be able to jump over a height, is she more flexible, is she stronger, or is she a combination of all of those things? In other words, do they do tests on somebody like her, and to extrapolate that, do they do tests then going right down the chain of abilities where you can do a baseline test to say this person can jump over 2 meters from a standing start and therefore they have an ability to be able to be a good gymnast? I mean, is there a way of testing that?
Yeah, it's interesting because that type of testing you're talking about is slightly a bit different in gymnastics to the way it's done in a lot of other sports. You know, other sports could be a set, you know, procedures that are used across different types of sporting codes. So whether you're a rugby player, a soccer player, a tennis player, you'll all be tested on a counter movement jump. So stand in one place, jump as high as you can, and that will give you some measure of some of these qualities. That type of testing is relatively uncommon in gymnastics. They tend to be more kind of specialized or sport-specific, if I call it that.
Like functional, kind of gymnastics functional. Functions.
So they will test you to see like how many pull-ups can you do. And it's all very much body weight specific. So how many pull-ups can you do to fatigue? You know, leg lifts, hanging on a bar, rope climbs for time, things like that are kind of the typical testing battery in gymnastics. So it's kind of difficult to compare. Like, I wouldn't even be able to say, yes, she's, you know, strong, can jump higher or further than another athlete in another sport, because those testing methods are really quite different.
So in other words, she's I know you haven't tested her, but ideally you could hypothesize that she is stronger, faster, technical. She's combining all of those extraordinary skills into one almost perfect gymnastics package.
Yep, I think that's fair to say.
Because I suppose the tendency, or certainly my inclination, is to try and maybe be reductionist in the same way that I'd say a runner has high VO2 max, efficiency,
yes,
autonomy,
that's what I'm
and
lactate
threshold.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a limit set by one of those things. I suppose that is to some extent true in gymnastics, is that if you don't have sufficient strength or power, if you don't have technical ability or whatever goes into creating the skill execution, you're also limited by them. But it's not as linear as it might be in some other sports.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that's changed and is continuing to change in the sport over the years. There's definitely more of an emphasis on strength and power training, and there is sort of more general type of training in those fields kind of coming into the sport. So the athletes now are starting to do like Olympic lifts as part of strength training, which was very, very rare in the in the past. I was actually listening to someone recently saying how, in particular, the Chinese women's team have employed somebody, you know, specifically to focus on lower body strength and power development, because the rules of the sport have sort of demanded that you, that's what you need to develop in order to perform at this level with the difficulty requirements to win these days.
And Ellen, that evolution is quite interesting, because that's driven in part by, let's call it, natural pursuit of the Olympic motto, faster, higher, stronger. But it's also, as I understand, been driven by the way they've changed the scoring to actually reward athletic performance execution maybe a little bit more. Because most people will, if you say gymnastics at the Olympics, they say Nadia Comaneci, 1972. Look that up, and that's a perfect 10. There were many perfect 10s. That is an almost unrecognizable sport compared to what you'll see in Tokyo. And I'd like to, maybe we can spend some time talking about A, technology, and then B, actually how just the scoring changes have driven the sport in a different direction that maybe rewards athleticism instead of artistic elements. Hasn't replaced them, but would that be fair to say?
Yes, definitely. I think so. Let's start with the scoring system. You're right. So the perfect 10, as it was back then in the 70s, or even all the way up into the early 2000s, no longer exists, because there was a move to change from that. I guess, kind of, if you watched the gymnastics through the 90s, especially the early 90s, every single gymnast was scoring a 9.95. And all the routines kind of looked very similar. So I guess the sport got to a point where the difficulty levels were very similar across the board. Execution was very good. And I guess the FIG decided they needed to change it up. So in 2006...
FIG being the International Federation, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So 2006, yeah. I think it was when the new scoring system came in that separated out the difficulty score and the execution score. So now you still, the perfect 10 sits in only in execution, right? And then there's a separate difficulty score, and the two of them get added together to give you the total. So the scores you'll see, like the final scores on each apparatus in the Olympics, will be like in the 13s, 14s, 15s.
And are they weighted equally, difficulty and execution, 50% each?
No, well, they're weighted equally, sort of. But the execution score starts from 10 and gets deductions from that, whereas the difficulty score starts from zero and adds up. So typically your difficulty scores, you'll see the top athletes doing, will be like between low fives to low mid sixes. So like a Simone Biles will on average have like a difficulty score of around 6.2 across the four apparatus.
Is that then made up? So let's say it's 6.2 and it's in the floor where again, we're going super basic here. The floor routine has a time limit. Is that right?
Yes. 90 seconds.
Is there a minimum requirement? So in those 90 seconds, is there a minimum requirement that the gymnast must perform a set number of elements?
Yeah. So they each...
And is each... Yeah, sorry, go on. Yeah.
Cool. I think so each apparatus has like... certain requirements that someone has to do, like you have to do a certain number of flight elements, a certain number of dance elements, so leaps and twists and spins type of thing. You have to do a certain number of different combinations. And that, if I stand to be corrected, I think if you meet all those requirements, you end up with a difficulty rating of 2. And then your top eight, women's top eight, men, I think it's their top 10, when I say top, the most difficult skills that you do, those all add up to give you your total difficulty rating. And each skill that a gymnast does has got a difficulty rating from A to J. Mm-hmm. And A is worth 0.1, B 0.2, all the way up to J, that's worth 1.0.
Yeah.
So if you do a J skill, you'll get a 1.0 added to your difficulty score. And
if you fail to execute that skill, do you lose the difficulty allocation, or do you only lose on the execution side of the final score?
It can be a bit of a gray area. So if you executed in such a way that it changes its format. So let's say you're going to say you're going to do a double pike somersault and you bend your knees and it turns into a double tuck. You'll get the difficulty for the double tuck. But if it's like a, if you just have an error on the landing of the double pike, you'll get the difficulty value for double pike, but you'll get a deduction from your execution score.
Okay, so you'll get perfect execution for the double tuck, but the difficulty score comes down. Or do you lose execution and difficulty if you change this element midway through it?
Well, I mean, yeah, if you change it midway through and it's noticeable, you'll get a deduction. But the judges, with the exception of vault, the judges don't know what you plan to do. Well, they've got an idea, but...
That was my next question, yeah. So,
you can do whatever you want. When you get up on apparatus, they will judge and give you the difficulty value for whatever you actually do. On vault, you do have to nominate what vault you're going to perform. But, these days, actually, it's changed over a few cycles. If you change what you're going to do, you just get marked on what you actually do. In the past, at one stage, you could even get a zero if you did the vault, a different vault from what you nominated. That's changed.
And judging wise, a few questions. One is, do these judges have the benefit of slow motion replays, or must they assign their score in real time? And then secondly, how many are there? And it used to be that they used to take your score from, say, I don't know how many it was, and then they used to take out the highest and the lowest. And I think that was done in part to try and address certain corruption and bias issues. Yeah. Does it still work that way?
Good question, Ross. I'm not actually sure how that's changed. I know that I think there's 9 judges on this full panel. I think it's two that determine the difficulty score and 5 that do the execution. There may well be top and bottom thrown out as well. I'm not sure. But the other two is actually the review panel. This is what you're talking about now. So the initial adjudication is just on real-time assessment. But there can be a review if the coach or the gymnast feels that you haven't given them full value for what they've done. Then they will look at video replays to say, did you actually make it all the way around in your triple twist? The judge might say, no, it's only a 2.5, but you can kind of say, no, I think I should get credit for the triple.
Because that's a source of some controversy. I know that I don't know much about the technical side, but I do know that there's quite an interesting study. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Helen, where some researchers went back and they looked at decades worth of the Olympics. And they said, okay, at the Olympic Games, there are 3 categories of sport. There are the sports that are entirely objective, like running and weightlifting. There's no subjectivity involved. You either run 9.75 or you're a 9.82 and you come second. Then there are sports that are entirely subjectively scored, and gymnastics was like this, certainly in the past, still to a large degree. And then there are some that are determined objectively but subjectively influenced, like football and hockey, where it's a referee decision. And what they found is that home advantage makes a very large difference to the subjectively scored ones. And there are some pretty significant controversies in gymnastics where home athletes have certainly benefited from crowds. And if I was a Japanese gymnast, I would be most unhappy about the fact that I have no crowd support in Tokyo, because that was worth points.
Yeah, definitely. I think you see it, especially there's a bit of controversies in gymnastics when there's like home competition. So not necessarily home advantage, but at the US nationals. Well, the Russian nationals, you tend to see these inflated scores coming out, and everyone around the world gets very excited that this athlete is scoring so high. And then people say, well, calm down a little bit, because the home scores tend to be more lenient of, giving credit for the skills that might not receive the same credit with an international judging panel.
Huh. And just last question on the scoring. For the floor, for instance, that routine is submitted to the judging panel in advance of the actual element or the performance.
I'm not actually sure if they do that these days, to be honest. What is really interesting on the judging, people could look us up, is that the judges use this like hieroglyphics type of coding system to note something down. So when you see if you see a screenshot of a score sheet, it really looks like hieroglyphics. Every single skill has got this little symbol. I'm not actually sure if they submit that, what they plan to do, to the judges anymore. They have done in the past, but I'm not sure if that's still the case. It would make it a lot easier for the judges to write down the hieroglyphics.
Yeah, to have a script they can evaluate the performance against. Yeah. But the thing that obviously is submitted is Simone Biles now has worked on these skills that you mentioned that she uniquely can do. She's obviously done that in training and then said, I'm going to submit this to somebody and they are going to recognize this as an official move, which has a difficulty score. That's obviously a formal process of submit application and evaluation and so on, yeah?
Yes, that's right. And because, the judges need to know what to do with it when they do something that's not in the code of points. So, for example, that's kind of pending at the moment. People might have seen in the media that at a local US competition a couple of months ago, she competed a new vault, which is a Yurchenko double pike. That's not in the code of points, so she had to apply a rating for that. It was given a rating of, I believe, 6.6, which is the highest in the women's program. But it won't officially become recognized, won't officially become named after until she does it in competition successfully in a world or Olympic competition. So that might happen this week.
Tell us how you figure out what athletes are better at certain disciplines. In other words, if you've got people that are very good, I know that you've got the individual competition that includes all the different disciplines, but there are obviously specialists in those different disciplines where you have the best in the vault and the best on the floor. Are certain athletes designed and how are they designed differently in terms of their physiology for those different disciplines? In other words, what makes a good vaulter, what makes a good floor athlete?
Yeah, so typically, you might want to classify the gymnasts as to kind of the shorter, stockier, more muscular build, and the gymnasts that are slightly taller, slightly leaner build. And normally the shorter, more muscular build tends to be the stronger vaulters and floor workers because of the tumbling and, tumbling and vaulting reliance on power and aerial rotations being shorter is an advantage. Yeah. Whereas
the lever arm or the
So the moment of inertia of a shorter person in a layout position is smaller than someone that's a taller person. And then the taller, leaner athletes tend to be stronger on bars and beam, where there's lesser demand on that power and somersaulting executions, and also where, gymnastics speak, you'll talk about lines, and then that sort of rewarded the aesthetic look of a long, lean line with increased flexibility, which tends to go hand in hand with this body type, is rewarded heavily on bars and beam. So that's sort of probably how it breaks down.
So in other words, if you have somebody that is a specialist, for instance, on the beam, do they all compete in the individual as well as the individual disciplines? In other words, if I am competing, can I just do the vault, or do I have to do the vault and the individual across all the disciplines?
Yeah, it is possible to just do one discipline or selected disciplines. The format at this year's games has got, there's a team. So there's a team competition, which is the sum total of multiple athletes from the same country that contribute to the team score. There's an individual all around.
And is that across all the disciplines in there for the team competition?
Yes, you can have different athletes kind of combining on the different apparatus. So in the team event, there'll be in the team final, each country has got a team of four athletes. And in the final, they can nominate three of those athletes to compete in each event. They can be different on different apparatus, and all three of those scores count. There can be another two athletes from a country that are not part of the four-person team, but are just competing as individuals, and they can be doing all around or just certain events. But all of this is sort of decided, or the qualification round is really important. So on the first day of competition, all athletes will compete. The four athletes that are nominated for the team for that country will all compete. And the top eight out of the 12 countries will go through to the team final. The top 24 individuals with their four apparatus scores combined will qualify for the individual all-around competition. And the top eight on each apparatus from the qualifying day will go into the final for just that apparatus. And with the exception that there's a limit of two individuals per country and on those individual events.
So if we take Simone Biles again, the aforementioned Biles, she's going to be in the qualifying. She'll do basically every apparatus. She is likely to qualify for the individual final on all four, all the apparatus, sorry. And she's likely to qualify for the all-round, and she'll compete in the team final. So she's got a busy week ahead of her.
Yeah, she definitely will.
Whereas the specialists are going to just do one apparatus in qualifying, hope to make top eight, and then come back to win a medal in that apparatus the night or two nights after.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm, okay.
So you're saying that she will potentially win gold in the team,
mm-hmm.
in the individual across all the disciplines, and yep. in all of the individual disciplines themselves?
I think she's unlikely to win each one of the apparatus, the vault, bars, beam, and floor separately. I think she's a good chance mm-hmm. on vault and floor. Possibly on beam, anything can happen on the day. If she's definitely got a very difficult routine, but consistency and risk is an issue always on beam for everybody. And bars, she's not the strongest. I mean, there's actually even a chance she might not be the second best from the US team. And in fact, the vault on that US team has been a bit controversial as well, because their two individuals are also very strong vaulters. So, I'd be very surprised if Biles isn't in that vault final.
Well, that explains it quite well. I mean, it actually leads me on to another subject, which I've always been quite fascinated to talk to somebody in this space. When we watch gymnastics, particularly when you watch young gymnasts, you know, who are probably peaking at 13, 14, 15, and you see the risks that they need to take. So I imagine when you're going for a complicated, and even at a very basic level, if you're running flat out down a runway, hitting a springboard and then jumping onto a vault, that the number of accidents that must happen on those apparatus, whether it's the beam where you fall badly, must be extraordinary. I'd like to ask you, how do you encourage young gymnasts to have the ability to take those risks, and how do you mitigate serious injury? Because they can be quite catastrophic, as you just have to YouTube gymnastics injuries, and there are hundreds of videos on this.
Yeah.
So how do you build confidence in athletes, and particularly young girls who are probably 13, 14, 15?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating skill development journey, right? And it's repetition after repetition of basic drills, you know, right from day one as a gymnast, and you're learning to do a forward roll and a handstand properly, and then gradually building up the complexity on each of these skills. So that's the one aspect. The other aspect is the physical conditioning around it. So you train these body positions and these shapes that you have the strength, the mobility to get into these shapes, and then that in combination with the technical drills, which in good stead. But there's also plenty of it's about progression. So progression, for example, you don't start the first time you do a new skill, it's not on the competition beam. You know, there's beams that are just 10 centimeters off the floor, so there's a lower element of risk. And putting padding on the equipment, spotting by the coaches who are there to take you through slowly through different skills, equipment such as like a trapeze type of system almost, where you've got a band around your waist on elastics that helps you in the air, and you can feel the somersaults. On bars, there's a system where you kind of strap your hands onto the bar when you're learning giant swings and things like that. So there's lots of assistive technology, spotting modifications that gradually take you step by step to build up to these complex moves.
Okay. And so there are obviously occasions when, despite all those assistive technologies, there are going to be some bad falls and accidents and probably some broken bones and torn ligaments. Do you just get them back on the horse as quickly as possible? I mean, what is the mental aspect of getting a young athlete to go, you've fallen, you've had a bad fall, you've got to get back onto that apparatus as soon as possible?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, and it's very, I think it's very individualized. You know, so obviously every athlete will experience that in a different way and come out of it with different attitude in terms of fear of going back and repeating it. Others might be of the mindset that they, you know, they do actually just want to go and overcome that and go for it again. So it's very individualized. And so the approach would be different to everybody. Going back to basics, building up again to build up that confidence. Yeah, it's not an easy one.
And is it often a defining moment in the progression of a gymnast, whether they, because they inevitably will fall, is that what defines whether they progress and continue to have the bravery side of it that keeps them challenging themselves?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a good point. It's a characteristic of your personality that you want to keep challenging yourself to do new things. And it's very much, I mean, I've always found it to be, as much as there's like competition and podiums and medals, it's really, you're really competing against yourself 90% of the time. Because you've got to be the one that gets up there and does the difficult and often scary things. And then the results, the judges, you know, take care of themselves.
I suppose it's so difficult for us even, or so, actually, let me speak for myself, for me to put myself in the mind of a gymnast. I mean, like, I can think of a downhill mountain biker.
Yeah.
The appetite, the appetite to accept risk probably determines the level you might reach. Because at some point you actually say, you know what, I just cannot go any, I just can't take the risks that'll knock 2 seconds off my time. And so that's why I'm going to come 15th instead of top three. I don't know. So I suppose it must be like that for all sports. But I guess what I'm asking is, does a gymnast standing at the end of the runway running up to the vault, they're not afraid?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
No, they shouldn't be.
Do you think that? at that point, so like if I was to ask a gymnast, like, what are your concerns? They're not fearful.
No, not if once they've decided this is the skill I'm going to do in this competition right now, there shouldn't be fear there at all. During the learning process, there may be. And that's where things like, well, let's, you know, scale it back a bit, do some more with spot, do some more with a mat there for safety, to work through that fear, because no, you can't be afraid when you're out on the.
Remember we asked. Remember the first we interviewed Gary Kirsten, and the first question we asked him is, when you're standing at the MCG on Boxing Day and Brett Lee is trying to knock your helmet off your head with a cricket ball, are you scared? And he said, no, I'm scared of failing. And being embarrassed and going out, but I'm not physically afraid. And I would imagine that's the characteristic, right? But I will say this, is that one of the fascinating psychologies in sport is when an athlete fails in competition and they fall off the bar or the beam and they have to continue. Yeah. And then you see, you can actually sometimes see confidence leaving this person's body. They've just lost it. And that's a really interesting insight, that you can visibly see confidence evaporate.
Definitely. And I think you know, in a situation like that, there's a defining moment. I think you said just now in another context, you know, you fall. Yes, you're going to lose a large deduction from your execution score for that. But you've got an opportunity to do the rest as well as you can and not make things worse and potentially still, you know, finish top five and whatever. And what the mind does in that space of going, oh, I've blown it, I'm done, or that was a mistake, let me do the best I can going forward. That's something that's really interesting and something that's coached. You know, you try and prepare for those situations as well, so that the gymnasts do the best they can.
I remember one situation, sorry, in the Sydney Olympics in 2000, they set the vault at the wrong height. I think the vault, I was reading up on this, the vault's meant to be 120 centimeters off the ground, and sorry, 125, and they set it at 120. And in the warm-ups, all the athletes were failing to land their jumps. And the coaches said, oh, it must be nerves, it must be the occasion getting to them. And then the favorite was a Russian called Svetlana Korkina. And I remember this actually. And she did this vault and she landed on her knees.
Yeah.
Because she just, that 5 centimeters was enough of a difference that she couldn't finish the skill.
Yeah.
And everyone was stunned. And eventually an Aussie gymnast went to them and said, you know what, something's wrong with this vault. And sure enough, they tested it and it was too low. Corkina didn't recover from that. She couldn't, even though it wasn't her fault, she couldn't put it out of her mind. And they gave them the opportunity to jump again. She said, no, I'm done.
Sure.
Yeah, it was a disaster. I mean, how often I can't believe that happened.
Does that happen often, or is that a really rare occurrence?
That's the one and only time I know of it in a major event. It was a huge disaster.
Sure. I always think, I mean, maybe you can give us a bit of an insight into what the gymnastics community see in this space now. When we were growing up, and there was always these stories about, you know, the Russian athletes and the Eastern Bloc athletes who were, if they didn't perform well, and the Chinese athletes, they'd be sent to the salt mines. And there was a lot of young girls were put into positions where they were, you know, there was a sign that there was almost some level of abuse going on in terms of pushing these athletes to the limit when they were so young. Is this sport healthier in terms of that now compared to what it was in the 80s, 90s maybe?
Maybe on the physical side, but gymnastics has got the biggest scandal in sports history hanging over it.
It does, yes. Well, we don't want to get into that, but I'm talking more specifically about
the physical.
The physical pressure being put on the young athletes, because they are relatively young from a mature aspect and an emotional aspect, but they are physically at their prime when they're mid-teens, aren't they?
Right. So, I mean, I think it has improved in certain environments and certain situations. You know, there used to be unhealthy weighing practices and things like that. Not that that doesn't still happen, but there's more of an awareness about, you know, the physiology behind diet and strength and training that in a more advanced program would not be, you know, applied in a negative way, but it definitely still happens. And Ross mentioned it now, you know, the sexual abuse scandal in the US has been massive, and I think we're going to still hear a lot more coming out of that. But through that process of that sexual abuse scandal coming out, gymnasts have also been speaking out about general physical and mental and emotional abuse that they've received through the 90s, early 2000s, but even some that are more recent, and not limited to the USA, that some of the, I think the British gymnasts, there's been a bit of in the media of British gymnasts speaking out about it as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think we'd be naive to say that it is a healthy sport all around. I think there's a long way to go. And I think that the stories coming out, and the especially the female gymnasts, current female gymnast standing up and speaking out against it is really key, and hopefully that will continue to improve the situation, because I don't think it's that healthy yet.
The thing is, though, like, isn't it, Helen, the case that gymnastics is a sport where you do mature and peak very young, and so the authorities have imposed age limits on the sport to try and to some extent mitigate that. But if you work it backwards from even a peak age in the early 20s, and maybe you can speak about what that age of peak is in a moment, you still have to start very young.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the moment you start working with very young people, especially girls, and the demands on a gymnast are so enormous. Maybe also you can tie into it a little bit on how many hours a week are they actually practicing and training. It's probably very difficult to do in a healthy way.
Yeah, it is extremely difficult balance just to fit in those physical training hours, right, throughout your childhood, teenage years. I mean, on the age issue, yeah, it's really interesting. I've read that apparently this is the first time that the average age of the female gymnast is over 20. I think it's close to 21 in this games. You know, throughout the 90s, it was probably in the 16, 17s, and it's gradually increased. So that's... that's interesting.
What's the minimum age?
The minimum is 16. So they changed the minimum age from 15 to 16. I think it was also in the mid-90s, maybe 2000, to try and encourage, you know, longevity of careers and things. But at the moment we're not sitting with an average age of 17 because of that change. It's gotten progressively older and older, which is interesting. And I actually think that's not so much to do with the age restriction change, but to do with the demands of the, you know, the scoring system. Because difficulty is so highly rewarded now, but at the same time as good execution, I think it's It's taking longer and longer. So athletes can continue to develop more and more difficult skills later on into the career. You can't teach a gymnast to do the triple twisting double back that Biles is doing at the age of 13. You know, those, it's that progression, that skill progression we talked about, and the physical years of physical training progression does take time. So I think actually the judging and the scoring system is also helping to increase the average age of the competitors. But you did write, Ross, that, you know, that does mean that the intense training is still happening through at a very young age. And in terms of number of hours and things, you're probably looking at easily 30, 35 hours a week from the age of 12, 13, 14 and up. Often two sessions, two sessions a day, which at the same time as someone is trying to go to school, these are not, you know, they're not full-time athletes trying to prepare for this life and this career. And it means, you know, the families put a lot on the line for this because of the hours away from home, they don't, you know, get school holidays away with families. And so that's where I think some of the tendencies towards the physical and mental abuse on the extreme side, or just the physical and mental pressure on these young girls to stick with the sport and that type of thing. It's a fine line.
And I guess to some extent, I mean, gymnastics is a bit, it's not a sport. It's a bit like ballet in many ways. It's hard on the young athletes. There's not necessarily a massive financial reward at the end of it either, is there?
No.
There aren't many professional gymnasts making lots of money here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, few and far between that will make a career out of gymnastics.
Well, my final question, and I'm sure Ross maybe has a couple of others before we finish, but if you could just give us a bit of a preview of what we were likely to see in Tokyo. Are there sort of themes that people can watch for in terms of the routines that people are doing, and maybe give us an idea of the countries that we should be looking out for and who are likely to be surprises in that?
Yeah, okay. So I think on the women's side, the strongest teams are likely to be, obviously, the USA. They also haven't lost a team competition since, I think, 2010. So they've really dominated the sport over the more than 10 years. But they'll be kind of pushed by probably the Russian team and the Chinese. And gymnasts from both of those countries will challenge in the all-round final as well, especially Russian gymnast named Angelina Melnikova is probably in the running. On the men's side, I think the competition tends to be a little bit closer actually, but Russia, Japan and China should dominate that team competition. Again, the Russian world champion, Nikita Nagorny, could probably be the favorite there. But especially in the team competition where, you know, three athletes compete on each event for each country, but all three scores will count. So any mistake they make can have a massive impact, and surprises. We often see surprises in the team competitions. Last World Championships, the women's Italian team managed to get the third place. So Italy, France in the women's side, USA and Great Britain on the men's side could challenge for those positions. I think maybe one definitely don't miss is Kohai Uchimura, the Japanese gymnast. If Simone Biles hadn't come along, I think, you know, we'd still be talking about Kohai Uchimura. He's, exceptional Japanese gymnast, won the 2012 and 2016 Olympics all around and every single World Championships in between. But I think he's only choosing to compete on the high bar this time around. But he's a legend in Japan as well. So also feels very sorry for him that there's no spectators in the competition.
So this is the first time actually that we've mentioned men's gymnastics, because yes, there is also one of those. And just to go very far back to basics, the apparatus are somewhat overlapping, but there are certain apparatus that only men and only women do. Maybe just quickly touch on those.
Yeah, so
unique to men is...
So the ones that are overlapping would be vault and floor exercise. So the men and women both do that. And then where the women have beam and uneven bars, so that's their four. The men have six apparatus in total, the other ones being pommel horse, rings, parallel bars, and the high bar.
Right. And On the issue of the men, I gather they tend to be older. You've just mentioned the Japanese gymnast who's in his third game. So, I mean, I'm putting him in his late 20s, I would imagine. So the men's age will be older. And is that just because
he's in his late 20s. I'm not 100% sure of his age, but yes, definitely his third games. And I think that, you know, average, the men would probably be around 24, 25 on average. Always has been.
And that again is because, the men's disciplines are really just pure athleticism. It's, you talk about explosive power. Some of the things you'll see there are remarkable, and strength. Like if you watch the rings, I mean, the when they do the, is it the Iron Cross and all those things? It's just, I mean, it'll make your eyes water thinking about it.
Yeah, exactly. So the two that are like most unique, you know, parallel bars and high bar, you can kind of see there's some crossover to what the women do on uneven bars. But on the men's side, the rings and the pommel horse, I mean, they're just 100% upper body strength. So impressive things going on there as well.
Just sort of on that, technology and gymnastics, I'd imagine there's a direct effect in terms of some of the apparatus. I can't see beam and rings changing from the ancient Olympics, well, not the ancient, but the original Olympics. But like the floor is certainly different. The vault seems to be different. That must have enabled certain things to evolve.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, like obviously, yes, the floor has become more sprung over time, but that hasn't changed a lot in, you know, 20 years or so. The ones that have changed a lot is the vault. So if you, I mean, people probably, I don't know, my age, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s might remember their old school hall days and the vaulting horse that used to be there, you know, just kind of a long, narrow, narrow thing. And that was the vault horse for, you know, Olympic gymnastics right up until 2003, I think it was. And now it's now called vault table. It's this much longer, broader surface. It's quite sprung. So that has definitely contributed to improvements in vault performance. It's a lot easier, a lot less risky to do these, especially the backward entry movements, the Yurchenko vaults that you'll see especially a lot of women do. So that's definitely one technological change that's happened. I think for me, the other big one is the uneven bars on the women's side. And do yourself a favor, like just look up YouTube videos about the evolution of uneven bars. And you go back to the 50s where women were literally, you know, standing on the low bar, hands on the high bar, doing these like static arabesque poses and things. And how that progressed to where you watch the 60s and 70s where you would hold the high bar and your hips would literally, like your legs would flip around the low bar wrap, but your hips bounce up again. And gradually the bars became kind of more flexible in terms of their give, which is one thing, but mainly became wider and wider distance between the high and the low bar. And now you see these, you know, release moves traveling from high to low and low to high. And I actually think that uneven bars has been, you know, the most profound change in the standard over the last 20 years. You mentioned just now, Ross, Svetlana Kolpina, who was a, you know, top. She won the Olympics in 96, I think, on bars, maybe 2000 as well, and had, you know, a couple of skills named after on bars. One was this one, it's sort of a release move from the low bar to the high bar with a half turn, very complex. And at the time, it was like mind-blowing that anybody could even think of trying to do this. And now, literally every woman in the competition will be doing some variation of that, some with more twists and... so that event has really changed. It's cool to watch some of the creative stuff they come up with and connect on uneven bars.
And then on the indirect side of technology, I mean, you spoke earlier about how you learn skills using a variety of supportive aids. That's technology as well enabling it. But I wondered if they use slow motion replay, biomechanical analysis in their development of these skills, or is gymnastics still in a sense, a rudimentary sport where you feel your way towards a new skill, or is it actually quite technically, physically planned?
Yes, I think some do and some don't use sort of that video replay approach. But it is very much about feel for the gymnast. And you say rudimentary, but you know, that is in essence what you need to do to perform the skill. So the feel of learning the skill and executing the skill is fundamental. some athletes benefit from, you know, seeing their movement patterns and execution and their errors, and then incorporating that into their corrections. And some don't. So that's also a really interesting part of the coaching process. In my approach with, and this is sort of generic across multiple sports, is that if I now wear my biomechanist hat, you know, I would look at the video and do the analysis. I'd look at 1,000 different things. I would then, you know, talk to the coach about a very distilled list of one or two of those things that I know that they, you know, they emphasize and could intervene on. And then ultimately the coach will decide how they want to communicate that to the athlete. They're the person that's best placed to do that. And they'll either say, okay, yeah, I'm going to give them this cue, or I'm going to show them this clip, or we're just going to do this drill. So that to get those corrections across.
Mm. Okay. So then my last question is sort of related to this technology and advancement you alluded to. If someone, let's say Simone Biles, decided in Tokyo that she was going to pay homage to Nadia Comaneci from 1976, I think I said 72 earlier, actually, so I'm correcting myself. It was 76. And Simone Biles goes out in Tokyo and executes the exact routine that Comaneci did in 76. What would she score? Do you know? Like, I mean, there's no doubt she'd come last. But yeah. I wonder by how much.
Yeah, I don't actually think she'd meet the minimum requirement. I was talking earlier about those, you know, you have to have a certain number of the skill and that skill. I don't know. I actually watched that Nadia routine the other day because it was the 45th anniversary or something it was on.
Right.
And at the time, that, you know, what she was doing on bars was quite revolutionary. But I don't know. Let me get back to you. I'm gonna now ask a judge friend to score it, and I'll let you know.
That's a brilliant question.
Yeah.
Helen Bain, I tell you, if I had a graph which would show the exponential amount of I've learned about gymnastics in the last 50 minutes, it would be a very, very steep curve. So thank you very much for your time. It's been amazing. And I certainly will watch the Olympic Games gymnastics with a lot more knowledge about what I'm watching. But so thank you very much for your time. If you want to catch up with Helen, she's got a great looking website, Helen. I have to tell you, it's a very impressive website. HelenBain.com, BAYNE is the site. There's a lovely picture of you on there, all sorts of research interests, and if you're interested in that side of gymnastics or anything else that Helen does, and she's got a very wide-ranging list of things that she does. But thank you very much for your time, Helen.
Cool, thanks a lot, it's been fun.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.